I'm Brady Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, schools are pushing political agendas on kids, but they're doing it under the guise of teaching kids empathy. Plus, Washington's paid leave program is heading toward insolvency. No surprise there. And state Democrats continue to push for the pardon of a convicted killer so he can avoid deportation. But the way they're doing it right now is very misleading. That and much more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at UndividedPod.com. That's UndividedPod.com. Click on the banner that says support the show. Hello, hello, and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. It's really nefarious the ways in which public schools will push a political or social agenda on kids, because they do it, and then they tell us it's not a big deal because they said they're just teaching kids basic lessons like the golden rule, you know, treat others how you want to be treated, and empathy, and all of these things. Except it's clearly indoctrination in this nice little pretty package that they tie a bow on, and they don't want us to push back because if we do, we're horrible people. But guess what? We don't care if you think we're horrible people, because we know that we're right. So we have a couple examples of this. One of them we broke on the show yesterday, and we have a follow-up today because the school is trying to explain to us why this very problematic thing isn't problematic at all. So we got this tip from a dad. He's got a ninth grader at Evergreen High School in the Highline School District, which is south of Seattle, so the Berrien area, if you're not familiar. And he sees the curriculum and some of the books that his student is going to be reading, and one of them is called The Book of Unknown Americans, and it's just got a nice little drawing of a cute girl in a pink shirt with a braided ponytail. What can be so bad at that? About that, The Book of Unknown Americans, and it's a fictional novel. And the description of the fictional novel, if you Google it, is basically about this story about a family from Mexico. The daughter needs medical care, so they decide to come to the United States in search of a better life and the medical care that she needs, whatever. So even if you were a parent and you get this, you know, you get the syllabus, you say, hey, here's the books that your kids are going to be reading. And let's say you do just the basic research and you go to Google machine and you type that book in and it says, oh, it's a story about immigrants. You know, maybe you don't look any further, except this dad did look further. He did look further, and he found out that it was very sexually explicit. And as we discussed and read passages, I had to read the passages. Oh, you're welcome. I don't get paid enough to read those passages live on the show. But it had passages about, you know, clearly adult sex themes and very descriptive and PPs and all this stuff. And then it had this really even more concerning passage because it was sexual, but it also clearly is intended to vilify immigration agents. It was talking about how people who come here go through all these horrible things. It says half of them ended up dead or burned up so bad that when someone finds them, their skin is black and their lips are cracked open. Another half of them drown in rivers, and half after that are picked up by La Migra, which is immigration, and sent back to where they came from, or beaten or arrested, or the women raped in the backside. Okay. So you have this book of fiction that ninth graders are not only having to read, but they have to read it out loud in class, certain passages. And at this particular time in America, while ICE is already being vilified by the Democratic Party, now kids are reading a book that says ICE agents are raping women who try to come into the country for a better life. Okay, so there's a lot of really concerning things. So we reached out to the Highline School District, as did the father who sent this to us and, you know, was obviously concerned about it. And we basically asked, you know, is this appropriate for ninth graders, and shouldn't parents know without having to do all this research on their own that this book has some pretty sexually explicit passages in it? So here's what we were told by the Highline School District, by their chief communications officer. This book has been used for a couple years in ninth grade language arts at Evergreen High School and other high schools in Highline. The book was selected because it supports key learning goals for ninth grade students, including analyzing character development, exploring themes of identity and belonging, and understanding diverse perspectives. These lessons help students build empathy, think critically, and strengthen reading and writing skills. Okay. I'm going to read more of it. But just, again, oh, that doesn't sound bad. We're trying to build empathy and help people think critically and strengthen reading and writing skills. Pretty sure there are other books that can help kids do that, that don't tell a fictional tale about immigration agents like raping women, right? And some of the sexual themes. He goes on to say, at the start of each school year, we send a message to high school parents and guardians and students through our notification system with a link to our core syllabi at all schools. Course syllabi outline the materials used in each class. And so he provided us with the Evergreen High School syllabus where this book is used, includes this exact statement. So he's saying parents were given this exact statement ahead of the start of the school year to describe this particular course syllabus. Some of the materials used may contain explicit or sensitive content, such as profanity and/or violence. All material will be age, grade, and subject appropriate and relevant to what we are learning. If you have any concerns about the materials used in class, please communicate them on a sign-off page at the end of the syllabus, and your student's teacher will make alternative arrangements. Okay, so if you're a parent, and before the school year begins, you know, you get that syllabus with that quote saying some of the materials used may contain explicit or sensitive content such as profanity and or violence. All the materials will be age and grade appropriate. Do you think as a parent that gives you enough information to know what the potential content of that book might be? No, of course not. And so are we expecting parents to get a syllabus and go through at the start of the school year and read every single book that their child might read during the year? Now, some of you parents might be shouting, well, yes, I guess we have to. And that's actually the subject of our daily show poll today. And so I'm curious what your guys' thoughts are on that. But I don't believe that that kind of warning given to parents about the syllabus accurately describes the sexually explicit nature of this book. And when you talk about these lessons, oh, this supports key learning goals for ninth grade students, including character development, themes of identity and belonging, understanding diverse perspectives, building empathy, thinking critically, and strengthening reading and writing skills. There are a bajillion books out there. You're telling me you can't find one that supports all of those learning goals, that doesn't talk about immigration agents raping women in a fictional tale, and all the other sexually explicit stuff that we read yesterday on the show that this book contains? Of course you can. Of course you can. This is, you know, selected very intentionally because it has sort of a political undercurrent to it, and it fits the leftist agenda. And he says it's been, you know, a book that the school has used for a couple years. This was still something that leftists were talking about a couple years ago. And the warning you give parents does not prepare them for what is contained in that book. It doesn't at all. But speaking of this theme of empathy, so we have another story sent to us by another father that is the same thing. It is using empathy to hide a real motivation, the real motivation of pushing your ideology on children. So this, it's Hispanic Heritage Month, if you didn't already know. I know our fearless governor, Bob Ferguson, put out a video where he and his wife stumbled through some Spanish to wish everyone a happy Hispanic Heritage Month. And so at Federal Way High School, the Latinx Club shared a presentation during a school assembly. So I thought they were doing away with Latinx. I thought that actual people found that term offensive, but apparently they are continuing with a Latinx club at Federal Way High School. So that club prepared this presentation for all students to see at an assembly. And here's the front of it. Hispanic Heritage Month 2025. Here is part of the over 4 minute long video that students at Federal Way High School were subjected to.
We are told we're illegal, but how can you trespass on the bones of your own ancestors?
The U.S.-Mexico border was not decided by nature or ancestry. It was decided by war.
And now we're criminalized for returning to lands that carry our names.
My food is older than your country. The potato in your fries, the tomato in your burger and pizza.
I am American, like the tomato that flavors your hamburger and the pizza you call your own.
So no, I'm not illegal. No, I'm not invading. No, I'm not an outsider.
I'm not illegal in the lands of my ancestors.
Before there was a Mexico, before there was a United States, before there were passports and fences and flags, my people were here.
If the American race has a face, This is it. I am it. The Native American race. I am the face of the original America. The real America. The American race.
If the American race has a look, I am that look. Brown-skinned Mexicans, the ones they call illegal aliens, and the ones they mock with slurs and ignorance.
We are not from somewhere else. We are the living descendants of the first civilizations of this continent.
Okay, a couple things. First of all, that was made with AI. You can tell, it's very obvious. So these aren't even real people delivering this message. It was whatever they used to generate these sort of AI videos. There's two very concerning things in there. There is a clear attempt to vilify immigration and thus vilify President Donald Trump's efforts to, follow the law and make sure that people come here legally. That's clearly an undertone. But there's one that I think is far more concerning. And you heard it at the end of that video. And that went on for 4 minutes, by the way. Which is nuts. You heard at the end of that video where they're saying, I am what a real American looks like, over and over. This is the face and the skin of a real American. Imagine if that were reversed. If it were a video of white people saying, I'm what a real American looks like, would never be allowed. So for all the kids in the assembly at Federal Way High School watching that who, you know, aren't Native American or have brown skin, what, they're not real Americans? They're not what a real American looks like? It's just fascinating that these people who are, you know, claiming racism and bias, they do what they say is being done to them and just opposite and do it to white people and white kids. And here's, I think, one of the kickers. The parent who sent us this to us is half Mexican and part Native Apache. And he's very offended by it. And he sent this over, and he also sent a note to the assistant principal. And he told us, I'm half Mexican, part Native Apache, and my father had a green card, and I still believe people should not be able to come to the U.S. illegally. He said, I told the school that even tribes didn't go into other tribes' areas. Even they had borders back then, he said. The assistant principal was very nice, and she said she didn't take the video the same way I did, but that she spoke with people who did the video and shared my thoughts and concerns. I'm just going to guarantee that the assistant principal is white. Can we ask the dad that? I'm just gonna guarantee, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I have a strong feeling the assistant principal is white. And you've got this dad who's half Mexican, part Native Apache, telling her, like, this is a very problematic video, you know, done with AI that shows, like, you know, traditional Native American head garb and stuff. And she's saying she doesn't find it problematic. We'll find out tomorrow. I guarantee the assistant principal is white. And then it didn't stop there. So in the video, in the presentation that the Latinx Club gave to Federal Way high schoolers, they had information in there on how to avoid ICE and how to avoid and not help ICE agents. It said, know your rights. If you're stopped by ICE, remain silent. You have the right to remain silent. Do not sign. Don't sign anything ICE gives you. Ask for a lawyer. Do not open the door. If ICE comes to your home, don't open the door unless they have a warrant signed by a judge. Even if you are undocumented, you are entitled to these rights under the United States Constitution. Now, I don't disagree with that. I don't disagree with the notion that people have rights when they're contacted by law enforcement. But in the context of this entire presentation, this was an entire presentation meant to vilify Donald Trump, vilify ICE agents, vilify the idea that the country should have lawful immigration and people should come here legally. And it was clearly meant to basically make all the white kids in the audience feel bad, like they're not real Americans. And I think there's just something that especially perturbs me about it being done with AI. Like, you couldn't find Native Americans or Hispanics to actually tape that video and talk about their real personal experience. You had to create fictional people delivering fictional lines that you fed them through an AI machine. That's interesting. Because if this were this, like, real profound problem, you would have no issue finding real people to tell their stories to this assembly. But it's just, well, Nicole, can we play that clip of the video one more time? Because, again, just picture Latinx Club, Federal Way, you know, student assembly. Like, picture being a white kid who's in there being forced to listen to 4 minutes of this.
We are told we're illegal. But how can you trespass on the bones of your own ancestors?
The U.S.-Mexico border was not decided by nature or ancestry. It was decided by war.
And now we're criminalized for returning to lands that carry our names. My food is older than your country. The potato in your fries,
the tomato in your burger and pizza.
I am American, like the tomato that flavors your hamburger and the pizza you call your own.
So no, I'm not illegal. No, I'm not invading. No, I'm not an outsider.
I'm not illegal in the lands of my ancestors.
Before there was a Mexico, before there was a United States, before there were passports and fences and flags, my people were here.
If the American race has a face, this is it. I am it, the Native American race. I am the face of the original America, the real America.
Real America.
The American race.
If the American race has a look, I am that look. Brown-skinned Mexicans, the ones they call illegal aliens, and the ones they mock with slurs and ignorance.
We are not from somewhere else.
Who's mocking you?
We are the living descendants of the first civilizations of this continent.
Yeah, okay. And Nicole just did a quick search that vice principal's name is Amanda. So something tells me, I don't want to jump to conclusions, but something tells me I was right about her being white and telling a father who's part Mexican, part Native Apache, that him being offended by the video doesn't reflect her experience with the video. Got it. Yeah, all of this, and they'll probably say, oh, this is about building empathy. No, it's about political indoctrination. You know it is. And thank God there are parents who have had enough of it and are pushing back and are letting us know about it so we can bring it to the light. Ridiculous. Good Lord. Can you imagine? Like, oh, I can't even.
And you know what?
I just can't even do
this
it.
This dad brought it to our attention, but his son was so offended by the video. He went home and told his dad. And his son is obviously of that heritage as well.
Got to have part of it, right.
So, yes.
Yep. Kids,
good on you, kid.
Good kids, obviously good parenting to let the child know, hey, there are some things that you shouldn't be taught in school. Come let me know if something makes you uncomfortable. Because that's, at the end of the day, I think one of the only safeguards we have is to make sure that kids are well equipped to be confronted with these things in our classrooms. So, all right. Coming up next, a Democratic state lawmaker is admitting that some of her votes and actions have made the juvenile crime crisis worse in Washington state. We'll get to that. First, it's Tuesday. Let's do a little testimonial Tuesday with our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. So Liz says she reached out to Wes after deciding that he offered her exactly what she needed. She said, I'm so glad we found Wes. They were exactly what I was looking for when I needed to sell my condo. Working with them was stress-free and no pressure. They gave recommendations on suggested improvements. I was able to pick and choose what I wanted to get done based on my budget. They coordinated everything with the contractor, including receiving and setting up new appliances. She said they offered up staging, but also gave me realistic expectations on whether I wanted to pay extra for physical staging or just do their virtual, which ended up being amazing, also saved her money. They also recommended price points, but ultimately left it up to me to decide. I love how they offered the exact support that I needed without any pressure. They were quick to respond to a few hiccups we had after I emptied the apartment and were overall just amazing to work with. She said, I appreciate all the support for a quick and easy sale. And for Liz, what really got her with Wes Jones and Associates is that listing boost concierge service. Again, we talk about it so often, and it really is a cool service where Wes is going to come in, going to do an assessment of your home, and he's going to make sure that if there are cosmetic upgrades that will help you on the back end with the final sale price, that those get done. He can take over the projects, take the stress off your plate, and even make sure you don't have to pay for those upgrades until closing. So it takes the financial pressure off as well. So that was really what sold Liz on Wes Jones and Associates. So if you're looking to sell your home, reach out to our friend Wes, sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. It really just is a better way to sell your home. All right, I will always give credit where credit is due, and I will always allow people grace to be able to come back to the light, to be able to realize the error of their ways and say, hey, I've had a change of heart. Here's why. And I think we have to allow people to do that or else nothing is going to be able to improve. And that is, I think, the change of heart that a Democratic state representative is having. And she wrote about it in an op-ed for the Seattle Times. This segment is brought to you in partnership with our friends at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. Make sure you sign up for their newsletter to be alerted to opportunities to do just that. All right. So the state rep in question is Rep. Lauren Davis. She's a Democrat who represents the Shoreline area. And over the last couple of years, I have seen her kind of come back towards sanity a little bit and start to make, you know, public statements about the crime crisis and things that concern her. And so she's sort of been on my radar as one of these state Democrats who's willing to go against the grain. But she acknowledges that it hasn't always been that way, and she kind of wishes that she could take some things back. She wrote this op-ed in the Seattle Times. Wall Lawmaker, How My Missteps Fueled Juvenile Violence. So I want to go through, really, there's so many things in here that she kind of acknowledges were wrong and that the legislature should go back and fix. And I want to go through a few of them. But she starts the piece by saying, in the past year, I've sat with weeping mothers, constituents of mine, whose children were slain by fellow teenagers. Juvenile arrests in Linwood, a city in my legislative district, have nearly tripled from 130 in 2022 to 355 in 2024. During these heartbreaking meetings, I find myself racked with guilt. I am culpable, she says. So she goes on to talk about a few reasons she thinks that we're having a juvenile crime crisis. Now, I agree with most of what she says in here. There are a few things that she points to, like COVID-19, that I don't think you can blame this on COVID-19. She also talks on the top here about education. She says, in analyzing the causal factors in the epidemic of juvenile violence, the first contributor is the legislature's abject failure to fully fund K-12 education. She says at least 40% of youth on probation qualify for special ed, which has been sorely under-resourced. Positions that offer early intervention have been cut. One of my school districts had to lay off 13 family advocates and 2 drug and alcohol counselors. Now, I agree with her on the notion that special ed is underfunded. I do not agree with her on the notion that we have not fully funded K-12 education. There was a mandate that the state do so. The state spends more money on K-12 education than it ever has before. The real problem is they're not focusing on the right things. So then she gets into these steps that the state legislature has taken that has to do with kind of this broader theme that we've been experiencing across the country that was tied to race and social justice, which is we can't punish kids. We can't hold kids accountable for their conduct. We can't do that because that's racist. And that's sort of this theme that after 2020 really started to set in to the school environment. She said, youth entangled in our juvenile legal system are often in the grips of mental health and substance use challenges. Under Washington state law, youth 13 and older can refuse behavioral health treatment. Parents keenly aware that their children are unwell are rendered helpless. The legislature attempted to remedy this, but the measure fell short. So glad she acknowledges there that parents are helpless to help their kids in these situations because the state and Democrats have taken away the ability of parents to be involved in their child's medical care. She goes on to say, Washington's top referral source for youth addiction treatment used to be schools. Typically, a student would be suspended for a substance-related violation and required to get a substance use disorder assessment and comply with treatment before returning to school. But she says the legislature barred this practice, resulting in a massive decline in treatment admissions for adolescents battling addiction. What she's talking about there is so important. And for those of us with common sense, we knew that those steps would lead to that. We knew that giving kids 13 and over, you know, basically carte blanche to get the medical care or not get the medical care that they choose was going to be problematic. Cutting parents out of their kids' lives is never a good idea. Acting like wholesale, even with no evidence of abuse or neglect, parents can't be trusted to make medical decisions with their kids is absolutely ridiculous. So you've got a kid who can decide totally on their own after 13 whether they need medical or mental health treatment or substance abuse treatment, and the parents, as she points out, are left and rendered helpless. So it's this whole environment of, oh, you know, it's okay, kids, you do whatever you want, and then you decide what the consequences will be, and you decide what the remedy will be. She goes on to say, during my first legislative session in 2019, I voted for Senate Bill 5290, which prohibited juvenile detention as a sanction for status offenses like truancy. She says, I distinctly remember the floor debate. My Republican colleagues passionately argued that we should not remove juvenile detention as an option until we build up a statewide network of residential crisis centers as an alternative. They were right. I mean, this is really a stunning level of self-awareness from a state Democratic lawmaker. To say, she says, overnight after this was passed, court orders related to truancy and at-risk youth petitions became unenforceable. We tied the hands of schools, parents, and courts and removed a crucial tool to get children help before they commit a crime. And I would say, well, duh. But I'm okay 6 years later with her making that realization. And being honest and reflective of it. We've talked about this on the show before with like Bob Ferguson, and I think that in the next couple years, the tides will change on some of these controversial issues like no boys and girls sports and things like that. And I said, what'll probably happen is you'll have a whole slew of Democrats who say, oh, I felt that way the whole time, and will never like acknowledge that they made a mistake. And they'll just try to move forward and pretend like nothing ever happened. And the same with Bob Ferguson on failing to call out, you know, political violence from the left. And then all of a sudden he's running for governor and he's acting like he's always been against political violence. This is not that. This is someone who is saying, I was wrong. Here is excruciating detail of all the votes I took that were wrong and the consequences that those votes now had. That's leadership. I probably still don't agree with her on a ton of things, but I will never question that she has the true markers of a leader. She goes on to say, in 2021, another example, I voted for HB 1140, which in effect bars law enforcement from interviewing juvenile suspects, including those under investigation for serious crimes such as rape and murder. I thought I was voting to protect juveniles, but in actuality, juvenile assailants became protected at the expense of juvenile victims. This legislation has significantly impeded law enforcement investigations, resulting in the denial of justice for victims and a missed opportunity for intervention with juveniles engaged in escalating criminal conduct. Could not agree more. And that seems to be a common theme that Democrats have pursued, is protecting criminals at the expense of all victims. You know, even if those victims are themselves people of color. Even if those victims are themselves juveniles. So they never look at the victim side of it. So you could say, oh, the criminal justice system disproportionately impacts people of color. So we need to, you know, lower sentencing enhancements and give them opportunities for early release. And they ignore the fact that a lot of the suspects of color had victims of color. So what about justice for them? And the same thing on the juvenile crime crisis. When it comes to these young kids that are in gangs and committing acts of gang violence with firearms, today's shooter is tomorrow's victim. They're out there just shooting other kids. So if you're looking at, you know, let's say two 16-year-olds, and who should the criminal justice system be on the side of, the 16-year-old shooter or the 16-year-old victim, the scales should probably tip to the 16-year-old victim, don't you think? And that is what State Representative Lauren Davis is saying here, and that she's now come to the conclusion after being in this room with her constituents, mothers who've had, you know, their young children killed, that she was wrong. And she goes on to end the op-ed by saying, basically, you know, we contribute to those problems, but we're not powerless to fix them. And so I pray that that sentiment can be passed on to her fellow state lawmakers. I am not going to hold my breath, but I think she is owed a tremendous amount of gratitude and credit for being able and willing to do something that's very hard, and that's admit you were wrong. It is the worst thing in the world to have to do, to admit you were wrong. But I don't think that you can be truly trustworthy and you can be a true leader until you can do that, because we all make mistakes, right? Her mistakes might have had consequences that were more severe than an average person's mistake, but admitting that mistake is the first part of moving forward. That segment is brought to you in partnership with our friends at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. Make sure you sign up for their newsletter to be alerted to opportunities to do just that. Future42.org. All right, speaking of, you know, admitting you were wrong, even in the face of a bunch of people telling you for years that you're wrong, maybe state lawmakers will finally admit they were wrong on some of these massive programs that we've been warning them for years will be insolvent and are completely unfeasible to continue. So one of those examples I can think of is the long-term care program. So they thrust this long-term care program on the populace, gave people just a short period of time to be able to opt out of it. And the program is basically worthless. It gives you virtually no benefit. You pay into it for your whole life. And if you do use it, it's going to be able to cover the cost of like 3 months of long-term care. But also, people said at the beginning, it's going to be immediately insolvent. It's not going to be able to continue to fund itself, but they don't care. They do it anyway because they know that they'll just continue to come back and charge people more and fund it with taxes and backfill it and all these things. So the same thing is happening with Washington State's very popular, albeit paid family leave program. So this is from the Washington State Standard. This is so annoying because everyone knew that we would, well, not everyone, sane people knew that it would be insolvent. And what is it doing? It's heading toward a fiscal cliff. State Standard says Washington's paid leave program heads towards a fiscal cliff. More than $350 million deficit looms in 2029. First of all, this is like a brand new program. And it's already going to have a $350 million deficit by 2029. It says without changes to either raise more tax revenue or lower costs. So the State Standard reports Washington's innovative paid family. Can it be innovative if it's insolvent? I don't think so. I don't think you can characterize it as innovative. Washington's innovative paid family and medical leave program could be hundreds of millions of dollars in the red within a few years unless the legislature acts. This could mean reduced benefits or increased payments by the employers and employees who fund the program, which lets Washingtonians take paid time off work for serious health issues or to care for a family member or a new child. The program's actuary says paid family and medical leave could face more than $350 million in a deficit by 2029. The state sets a premium rate annually for how much employers and employees need to pay into the program. This year, 0.92% of Washington workers' paychecks go toward it. Next year, that's projected to increase to 1.13%, though the rate will be finalized at the end of this month. So already, and look, Washington voters had a chance to get rid of this. It was a Let's Go Washington initiative. It was on everyone's ballot. Last November.
That was the long-term care.
Oh, sorry. Thank you, Nicole. Long-term care. We didn't get rid of that. We should have gotten rid of that. This is something different. Thanks, Nicole. I was like, ah. Goes on to say, the problem is that state law caps premiums for the paid leave program at 1.2%. So think about this. So next year, the premium is already expected to be at 1.13%, but state law caps it at 1.2%. So it's already racing toward the cap that the state legislature set. So the state is projected to reach that cap in 2027 and stay there. That plateau means the program likely won't be able to keep up with rising claims for benefits and increased payments as wages grow. The program has been steadily growing since its launch in 2020. From July 1st, 2024 to June 30th, over 320,000 applications were submitted for paid leave, up 15% from the previous year. And this line that the story ends with, I think, foreshadows what's to come. Senator Steve Conway, a Democrat from Tacoma, says this plan is too popular not to be better funded. There it is.
And do you know where all the money is going?
Dads that want
to stay home with their babies.
Yeah, which, look, I'm not going to hate on dads who want to stay home with their babies.
But first it's all, extending leave. So right. Yeah, I don't know.
I don't support the program. I'll just say I don't support the program. There's a lot of things that people want the government to give them. There's a lot of things people, freebies that they want. That doesn't mean it's the government's job to provide them. Mm-hmm. It doesn't. And so something can feel nice, can sound nice, doesn't mean the government and therefore the taxpayers should give it to you.
Exactly.
That's the case here. And so the warning was, this is going to be a very popular program. And why wouldn't it be? Like, yeah, dads are going to be like, well, I'm going to use that to stay home with my new kid. Mm-hmm. And a lot of companies have modernized, and a lot of private companies now offer maternity and paternity leave. And so they don't treat the mother and the father any differently and all these things. You know, but there's also this wide range of other things that this can be used for, like caring for a sick loved one, or if you have an immediate family member who passes away. And look, some of those things, again, sound nice, but is it the taxpayer and employers and employees who pay in for this that should be footing the bill for it? Because you could pay into this your whole life and never have a necessity to use it. I mean, I've never had a child. Mm-hmm. So I'm essentially, through, you know, parts of our paychecks that we had when we were working regular jobs, we were funding other people's ability to be able to take time off with their kids. Is that my responsibility? I don't think so.
I'm all for
it. I don't think it is.
Incentives to businesses to do that for their employees. So I'm for the government giving incentives. You know, I think that's what they do in Australia, places like that. They give incentives to companies to do that for their employees, give them more, because I am all for families bonding with babies, all of that. But this does not work.
No, it doesn't work. It's not solvent. And they're already going to, now they're going to take, what are they going to do? He already said, Senator Steve Conway, the plan is too popular not to be better funded. So what are they going to do? Well, they're either going to supplement it with some other sort of tax revenue, or they're going to increase the threshold, the 1.2% threshold. So now how much money is going to be coming out of your paycheck to go toward this program so you can support other people taking paid family leave? Is it going to be 2%, 3%, 4%, 5%? Where is the limit? I don't think that Democrats in Olympia care. I don't think that in their mind there is any sort of limit for the amount of money they should be able to take for you so other people can take time off work. So that's the reality. Either they're not going to let it go insolvent. They're not going to get rid of it. So the only option is increasing taxes and increasing the amount of money that's taken out of your paycheck. And it happened in a matter of hit the cap. They'll hit the cap in a matter of 6 or 7 years. That's all the time it took to be rendered insolvent. Absolutely insane. All right, coming up next, speaking of insane, Democrats sending a mass letter to Governor Bob Ferguson urging him to pardon a convicted killer so he can avoid deportation and remain in the United States. But the way that they're doing this is not only unethical, but I think it might be illegal. We'll discuss. First, our newest sponsors to Undivided, Valentine Roofing. If you need a new roof or you need a bevy of other services, they can help you out, including new siding, gutters, attic insulation, exterior cleaning. You can expect the same great service from Valentine. But if you are a homeowner and you know your roof is on its last legs, you know, and you're probably like, oh my gosh, I'm going to put this off as long as I can. Because look, there's no way around it. You know, having to get a new roof for your home is a major purchase, but Valentine can help you out. First, they're going to make sure that your roof can't just be repaired. I mean, that's the first thing to look at. Let's say you've already got some sort of leak. If they can come in and they can repair your roof without replacing it, they're going to do that. They're not going to try to pressure you into getting a new roof unless you absolutely need it. And so then they'll come in. They also offer zero down financing for most projects. So you can get the work done now, pay over time, which is really helpful. And they will make sure, like, let's say you know your roof is on the last legs, but maybe the weather isn't allowing for a replacement. They're still going to come in. They're going to do a free leak repair so they can stop any more damage from occurring. And then you can, you know, schedule time to get a new roof when it works. So schedule your free estimate by calling 206-ROOFING. Again, call 206-ROOFING. And please tell him you heard about them here on Undivided with me, Brandi Cruz. All right. Democrats in our state are going full throttle, pushing toward for a pardon for a convicted killer, all so they can say orange man bad. But they're doing it in a way that I actually think might be, it's for sure unethical, but I wonder also if it's illegal. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. Okay, so we have told you about the story of Tuan Pham before. So, I think we covered it back in July. The Seattle Times, KUOW, the who's who of leftist news organizations were running headlines, a couple of them. Pardon board declines to intervene as Hua immigrant faces deportation. Ferguson denies pardon for Hua immigrant facing deportation to South Sudan. So this is one of those these stories of you had an individual, in this case, Tuan Pham, who had been released from prison. Why? I'll get to more on that in a moment. But he then was facing deportation because he wasn't a lawful permanent resident. And the U.S. decided to deport him because of the crime that he committed. And they were deciding to deport people, remember, to not back to a country of origin. So they were deciding, in this case, to deport people to South Sudan. So this is one of those high-profile cases. And so, look, let me just say from the onset, I have a lot of empathy for families of people who are caught up in this immigration issue who didn't do anything wrong. You know, I have a lot of sympathy for family members of people who are incarcerated, who didn't do anything wrong. And they're just worried about their loved one. And I'm never going to fault them for that. But that doesn't mean that, you know, I'm going to say that their loved one deserves some sort of special treatment or deserves to stay in the country. I know, I guess, Tuan Pham's sister is a fan of the show and had emailed us after the first time we talked about his case. And I have a lot of empathy for her, but I don't have a lot of empathy for him. Why? Well, he's a convicted killer. And that was what a lot of these news reports in July weren't really, they were burying the lead, okay? The guy's a convicted killer. So a little bit of details, and DHS released this information. So he was convicted of first-degree murder and second-degree assault. He was an illegal alien from Vietnam. And he served 22 years. Prior to that, he was charged with possession of a dangerous weapon on a school facility as a juvenile in 1999. He had a final order of removal that was issued June of 2009. And in terms of his actual crime, so this was committed in 2000, he killed a teenager and injured another when he, like, shot into sort of an open area. So he's in the country illegally. He killed a teenager, okay? got 22 years in prison for it. And even Bob Ferguson, Governor Ferguson, who I would argue is very soft on crime, said, look, I'm not going to pardon this guy. And the family wanted him pardoned because they believed that that would make it easier to avoid deportation. They believed that if he got a pardon from the state of Washington, that it would make it easier for him to be able to stay in the United States and not get deported to South Sudan. So Bob Ferguson said in a statement back when we covered this in July, Mr. Phan was convicted of a very serious crime, killing one innocent teenage victim and injuring another when he fired a gun multiple times into a crowded area. He said, while incarcerated, Mr. Phan committed 10 infractions that the Department of Corrections designates as serious, several of which were violent. These included a serious infraction in 2023 for strong-arming intimidation and a serious infraction in 2018 for possessing drugs with the intent to sell and distribute. So Bob Ferguson, even Bob's like, I'm not pardoning the guy. You know, unfortunate if he gets deported to South Sudan, but he's a convicted killer. He killed a teenager, showed no care or concern for human life because he shot into a crowded area, and he wasn't a model inmate. And that's typically what it takes to get a pardon. You know, he wasn't a model inmate for the entirety of his 22 years there, up to 2023, when he was committing serious infractions behind bars. So he's like, no, I'm not intervening here. But Democrats aren't letting it go. So this letter went out, and it didn't get a lot of attention at the time. And so I just want to give it some attention now because it was sent to us and I hadn't seen it. So look at the, first, before I even read the letter, can you look at the logos at the top of it? City of Kenmore, City of Renton, City of Tacoma, Washington State Legislature, City of Seattle, King County, Port of Seattle. So without even reading the letter, what does that tell you? Doesn't it sound like all those cities and the Washington State Legislature officially and the Port of Seattle and King County, that this is a letter from them in an official capacity? Does it not? 100%. But that's not the case. Who the letter was actually written by were state representatives who, I don't know, represent districts within those cities, and King County Council members and Kenmore City Council members and Tacoma City Council members, but not in some sort of official capacity. But they used at the top of the letter to Governor Bob Ferguson official logos for all of the cities, which suggests that it's some like taxpayer funded overall effort to be able to get this guy a pardon. It's crazy to me. It's unethical for sure. But I also wonder if there's something illegal about it. But anyway, it goes on to read. So this was sent to Bob a couple months ago, but it was just sent to us. I hadn't seen it, and so I wanted to cover it on the show today. It said, Dear Governor Ferguson, as elected officials from across Washington, we're committed to a nation and a state where all people are equally protected under the law, including immigrants and people of color. Washington State is proudly home to diverse immigrant and refugee communities, some of who have lived here most of their lives, others who recently arrived. This is the time for us to stand up. It is incumbent on us as Washington State's elected leaders to do everything in our power to protect the immigrant communities that now face unprecedented threats to their lives at the hands of the Trump administration. And meanwhile, this is a guy who killed someone. And they're talking about, oh my gosh, we're going to fight to help him under unprecedented attack. What do you think they did for his victims? Victims' families. They don't care about crime victims. This just shows that there are Democrats in our state who genuinely care more about criminals and illegals than law-abiding citizens. He said, we call on you to immediately pardon Tuan. Doing so would save his life. It would allow him to be freed from U.S. custody, restore his lawful permanent residency, and return home to his wife and family in Tacoma. Doing so would save his life. After he took someone else's life. This is the mindset. This is the mindset of the Democratic Party in Washington State. So why am I talking about this today, given that the letter was written in June? Well, there's one name that was signed on it that I just have to point out ahead of the November election. Can you go back to the signature page, Nicole? State Senator Deb Krishnadonson is on there. 26th Legislative District, right now on the campaign trail for a critical seat that's going to be on ballots in November. She is running as a moderate Democrat and has presented herself as not the kind of cuckoo for Cocoa Puff leftists. And she's running against State Rep Michelle Caldier, who is trying to capture that Senate seat that Deb was appointed to. So that's why it's up for election this year. It's sort of a special election. She's trying to capture it, try to chip away at the Democratic supermajority. And right now, both of them are in this sort of battle back and forth. And Deb Krishnadasan is painting herself in the election as a moderate. Does that seem moderate to you? Is that a letter that a moderate would sign on to? Hey, let's give special treatment for the convicted killer so he doesn't get deported and he should get a special pardon from the governor. I don't think that sounds like something a moderate would do. So don't be fooled, people. Don't be fooled. Absolutely unbelievable. All right, coming up next, 250 ballots were found in an Amazon shipment in the state of Maine. It is a bizarre story that doesn't seem true, but it indeed is. We'll talk about it coming up next. First, with trade deals affecting global markets, the uncertainty of AI, certainly what's happening in the Middle East, you might be wondering, how does all of this impact my retirement portfolio and impact U.S. markets and global markets? Well, a good thing to do is just to get a second opinion if you're worried at all or you have any doubt. Our friend Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital can help you out with that. If you go to knowyourriskpodcast.com, knowyourriskpodcast.com, ask Zach for a free second opinion. He'll give you a free risk assessment, talk about the basic fundamentals of value investing, a perspective on the outlook for the remainder of 2025. Plus, he'll do a full reveal of how Bulwark is always looking for opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, give your retirement as much upside as possible. So go to knowyourriskpodcast.com, ask Zach and his team at Bulwark for a second opinion, knowyourriskpodcast.com. Okay, so Libs of TikTok put this out. And at first I thought, that's AI. It's one of those things where it was just too unreal to be true. So I was like, I think Libs of TikTok got fooled by AI. It said, WTF, a woman in Maine received 250 state election ballots packaged inside her Amazon delivery of food and toys. This needs to be investigated immediately. And they tag the Justice Department. And indeed, you've got some food, paper plates, and then these packets of what appear to be a state of Maine official ballots for the referendum election for November 4th, 2025. So I saw that. I'm like, AI, totally AI. It wasn't. No, this chick got an Amazon package to her door, opened it up, paper plates, food, 250 sealed election ballots. This is from Maine Wire. Confirms that the story is true. A Newburgh resident expecting an Amazon delivery of rice paper plates and a toy lightsaber instead opened a box to find 250 state election ballots. The discovery raised alarms about election security, leading the Maine Republican Party chairman to call for a federal criminal investigation, as the state is mere weeks from deciding on whether it will join 36 other states in requiring some form of voter ID. So this makes it even more fascinating, because that's one of the things that Maine residents are going to be voting on, is like whether to strengthen election protections and election integrity. And this chick finds these ballots in her Amazon shipment. It says the package arrived Tuesday looking beat up and retaped as if tampered with. Inside, along with household items, were bundles of ballots packaged in tamper-evident packs of 50, the same format used for official shipments to local clerks. Election officials who reviewed photographs confirmed the documents appear to be authentic 2025 ballots. The images provided to the Maine Wire by the resident who received the shipment shows part of the text of the second ballot measure on gun restrictions that will also appear on the November 4th ballot, language that matches the Secretary of State's final ballot wording. That detail, along with the tamper-evident packaging, strongly suggests the ballots are authentic. But so far, neither the Secretary of State's office nor the longtime ballot contractor, the Omaha, Nebraska-based Election Systems and Software, has provided an explanation as to how seemingly every law, regulation, and rule concerning ballot shipment and chain of custody could have been broken to place these ballots in an Amazon shipment. And I should also note, Amazon put out a statement about this saying that they are not responsible for those ballots being in the box. So Amazon saying, well, wherever this happened, like, was not at an Amazon fulfillment center. It wasn't us. It's just crazy. So on the voter ID sort of issue that's clearly now being raised over, you know, the need to protect Maine elections, 36 other U.S. states, as well as virtually every nation in Europe, have some form of voter ID law. Yet Maine Democratic Party Chairman Charlie Dingman has frequently downplayed the need for election integrity measures in Maine and fretted that if the, quote, yes on one effort succeeds in November, Democrats could lose as many as 13,000 votes in future statewide elections. In a May 30th text message to voters, for example, Dingman said that if Maine adopted voter ID requirements, it could result in a loss of 13,000 Democratic votes being counted in subsequent elections. He did not provide an explanation as to how the proposed voter ID law would prevent any legal U.S. citizen from voting in the election, nor did he explain how the Maine Democrats arrived at the 13,000 voter figure. It says, if the Maine Democratic Party chairman is correct, though, then those 13,000 voters who will mysteriously disappear from the election tallies if these are required to could reshape control of the state and even the U.S. Congress. So here you have this situation where the Maine Democratic Party has sworn up and down, we don't need voter ID. And they've said, if we get it, we'll lose 13,000 voters, but won't explain how, if requiring voter ID to prove citizenship, you would lose 13,000 voters. And then, month and a half before the election to make that decision, 250 sealed, seemingly authentic ballots for that very election show up in an apparently tampered Amazon delivery box with rice paper plates and a toy lightsaber. I have two theories, okay? Theory number one, without accusing anyone of a crime, some sort of Republican that was somewhere in the chain of custody did this to, like, make a point about, like, secretly kind of a, oh, look how unsafe our elections are, and, like, sent it to their buddy's house to say, hey, let's get this on the news. Okay, I'm not going to rule that possibility out. Or someone along the chain of custody for ballots is part of an operation to sway the outcome of an election, and those ballots were part of that effort and wound up in the wrong place. Those only two options, because clearly someone opened the box, put them in with some destination in mind.
Because they do what? Say that those have to be destroyed because they so they have to be destroyed. I don't know if they automatically get reprinted or if somebody has to request a new ballot.
No, it looks like these are probably like blank in the sense that these aren't. Weren't sent out to individual voters. They would have come out of those packages. They would have been sent to individual voters.
So right. So they weren't addressed yet? Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't believe they were addressed to individuals yet. It's like blank ballots. So what were you going to do with the blank ballots? So that's the question. And I think the secrecy and the quietness from Democrats is very concerning. Because would you not immediately come out and be like, oh my God, we're investigating this. Clearly we're going to treat it like a crime scene. And we're going to figure out what happened here, whether it's the Department of Justice or the Secretary of State's office or whatever it is. So I'm curious what you guys think. I'm not ruling out the possibility that this was some sort of strategic plan to say, let's make it look like our elections are very unsafe. But if 250 ballots can go missing from a chain of custody like that, that does prove something, right? Mm-hmm. It's very concerning. All right, we'll get to our daily subscriber show poll coming up next, as well as questions and comments. First, we get so many good FirstMark insurance success stories from you guys, and it doesn't surprise me because FirstMark is just great. Let's see. Lisa says, Brandy and Nicole, after watching you from day one and hearing about FirstMark Daily, I finally talked to my husband about doing the challenge. They were amazing to work with, very attentive to the issues. Unfortunately, they were not able to help us with our personal insurance. However, when I asked about a business policy, I was transferred to Marie in the commercial department after a couple meetings. And a few emails later, we had an offer that saved us nearly 50% a year on our rates and gave us more coverage with a policy that met the needs of our business much better. See, God, what a win. She says, thanks for all your hard work. When I told Marie how we heard about them, she said, oh, Brandy's great. Thanks, Lisa. Always nice to hear a little compliment. So do what Lisa did, what so many other undivided viewers and listeners have done. Take the FirstMark challenge today. FirstMarkInsurance.com. FirstMarkInsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you, not the insurance companies. So they always have your best interest in mind. All right, on to our daily subscriber show poll on Patreon, Locals, and X. Become a subscriber if you'd like to participate in these. This is a tricky one, and I'm sure I'm going to have people complaining about the poll, not being explaining enough information, but it was kind of the point. I wanted you to really think about this question. Do you believe parents or schools have the ultimate responsibility
to review curriculum to ensure it is age appropriate for students. Who has, Nicole, the ultimate responsibility?
I know, I've been thinking about that this whole show.
Well, you better think faster because we're here.
I'm going to say that schools should have a set rule. They should have a guideline that they go by. Mm-hmm. And then parents should review. So
yeah.
So parents should be a should review, but the schools should be abiding by some sort of guideline. Yep. And they're obviously not.
Yeah. I think in our state, parents have the ultimate responsibility for
they
sure.
They do have the ultimate responsibility to review.
Yeah.
However,
I agree. In a sane state, there should clearly be some sort of review done to ensure it's age appropriate. And what, because the issue is age appropriate is discretionary. It's up to who is deciding age appropriate.
It is, but we've figured it out for movie ratings.
Mostly, yes.
I mean, it's pretty clear. You know, PG-13. Everybody's pretty much agreed PG-13 is 13 and above, 13 yep. below, and everybody's pretty okay with the way that they're rated and pretty much agrees on how that's been applied.
Yeah, you don't hear a lot of complaints about it. No. I took my kid to a PG-13 movie and it was grotesque. Right. So you're right. I don't hear a lot of that.
But that's not the same in schools. Yeah.
Here's so we're about 75% of you say parents.
Yeah.
Which I actually thought it would be a little more even, but 75% of you say parents. Christopher says parents should not have to do this, but these days they do. And I think that's mm-hmm. what we hear is like, you know, the problem I have is that realistic? Like there was 8 books on that curriculum that dad got. Does he have to go through and read every single line of a book? That's going to take ages, and parents have all these things to do. So it's unfortunately it's not happening with the schools. But UF88 on Local says, my first job was as a school teacher. Teachers, students, and schools are graded by standardized test scores. Getting into a great university is based on test scores and grades. Grades are so subjective that standardized test scores are more predictive of success in school than grades. Annette says, I want to say the schools have the responsibility, but they have not shown the ability to be age appropriate. Parents are the first teachers of their kids, and the schools should be an extension of that, but somewhere along the way, the schools fell off a cliff, thus increasing parental involvement so the kids don't get exposed to items parents don't agree with, and let alone way too soon. But you know, it's one of the issues too, is not only are they including these things that clearly aren't age appropriate, but they're making it more difficult for parents to be in the know, mm-hmm. for parents to review. I mean, think about, you know, the school sent us what it said for this curriculum, for this grade at this high school. And if a parent read that, it really was not a good indicator of what the book contained. And so, yeah.
I actually can't believe that they sent us that as an acceptable
thinking that we would be like, oh, yeah, response. That's the parent's fault. No.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
No, you just told us that you think that that book was age appropriate, which is troubling. So now I want to go read every other book assigned to ninth graders.
Right. And you told the parents that it had adult language and violence, and that should explain that book.
Right.
That, no.
It said nothing about sexual themes at all.
No.
Sherry Tinkley, in today's world, parents need to be very involved in what's being taught at school. Can I also say that I love that it's dads shining the light on these problems, real men standing up for their families. Yes. I agree. And not just going to the school, because the school will just say, oh, poo-poo, like the white lady who told the native guy, like, don't be offended, basically. But, you know, letting people know so we can share that these things are happening so frequently, so frequently. I mean, every day we have a possible story we could put on the show. And those are just the ones that we're being informed of.
But I do love that both of these were brought to us by dads this week.
I love it because usually our tips are for moms.
Usually
our tips are for moms. Karen, we should be able to trust schools. Time and again, schools show us they cannot be trusted. Short of teachers sending parents the list of books to be used in their classrooms and parents reading all of them, parents are in the dark. Having titles posted on the district websites is not good enough. Teachers are known to make use of texts not listed by that's the other issue. Is that we've done stories of something that was not in the curriculum that was shown or taught to kids. So then parents are completely in the dark because you're just springing something on. Those are individual teachers making decisions they're not supposed to make and hoping mm-hmm. nobody finds out.
It so, really is. I think, you know, to go with this poll, that really it is making sure your kids are vigilant.
Oh, 100%.
Your kids are empowered to walk out of class, to tell you about it,
to just stay vigilant.
Yep. And we get a lot of tips from parents because their kids told them something. And that was the case today. Weiss Castle, none of this negates the responsibility of a school to use age appropriate material. I agree. Their responsibility is there. I just think the responsibility has been forced to fall on parents in a state like ours, where apparently they think talking about rape and, you know, graphic scenes of sex are appropriate for a ninth grader. It's just wild. All right, comments from the live stream. I just don't know if I can say some words on the show. I mean, I could say anything I want on the show, but will I get deplatformed is always the question. But doesn't that show you? I can't even, on an adult show for an adult, adults, I can't read out loud the actual words used in a book for ninth graders because I'm worried that we'll lose our YouTube channel. It's like, that tells you everything you need to know. All right. The school's response and comments from the feed today. School responds to our book backlash. Matthew Cook says, empathy is the complete opposite of critical thinking. Empathy, if overdone, relies on taking action based on emotion and feelings rather than action based on fact. Empathy can lead to indecisiveness. I agree. It's why, what is it, Ben Shapiro? Facts don't care about your feelings. Right. Like, I get it. We don't want to be cruel to people and all of this, but like, men aren't women, you know? Boys aren't girls. And if that makes you feel bad, I'm sorry, but it's just a fact.
And really,
great comment, Matt.
That principal, and I don't know if there was probably some other teacher that was involved in that video and or that class, if there was a teacher that oversees that class or something. But there were facts in that video that weren't correct, right? But I'm sure the kids made it and the teacher just wanted to be, you know, they were respecting their feelings and they were like, okay, well, I get the sentiment behind it. So we're just going to let that slide.
No, there was probably a teacher who was like, love this. This the best is video school. I've ever seen. Wild. Looking up for Jesus says, when you look at all this through the lens of turning children against their parents, it all makes sense. Yeah, the government can control you better when you're isolated. The family unit is one of like the strongest things against government indoctrination. So they can control you better. They can indoctrinate you when you're alone and isolated. That's what they want. Make no mistake. Andy Silly, $20 super chat. Thank you, Andy. Parental review of instructional material procurement will never work as long as instructional material committees are slanted toward educators. Yeah.
Sure. They're very sneaky.
Yes, they are. Moon Goddess 1282. When you point a finger at someone else, always remember you have three fingers pointing back at yourself. I'm just saying, stop being racists. I think that you're talking about the video that accuses. Yes. Yes. You guys are horrible people. Don't you have, three fingers.
I know.
Three fingers, yes. D-Man in Seattle. I never point at anyone, so that's why I wasn't sure. I was pointing at people feels mean.
You use a different finger when you do.
Yeah. D-Man in Seattle. Funny how they need fake AI-generated spokespeople because there's no real people saying that. Can I tell on you here a little bit?
Sure.
Nicole didn't realize it was AI.
Oh, no, I did. I'm just not going to... Well...
Did you, though?
No, I mean, did I didn't immediately go like, oh, yeah, that's AI. I recognize that not all of those pictures, like the pictures come to life. Those are obviously AI.
Oh, yeah.
But some of the, like the kid talking and stuff, I didn't know if it's all AI or I realized that it was like put together.
Yeah,
somehow,
they could have been real pictures where they made them come to life. That's possible, but that's still AI, obviously.
The historical photo come to life, I recognize is AI.
All right, okay. Just making sure. All right, let's see here. Egamorph, why does the left scream racism for anything, but then turn around and create some of the most divisive and racist content and talking points? These people are clueless, or it's on purpose. They're clueless. But even if they weren't, then it's on purpose.
I just think they're not critical thinking. I think that's a thing with that principal admitting that she hadn't thought of that. She didn't view the video the same way. They're not critically thinking about these things. No. They're just, it's sentiment. It's
virtue
they're not
signaling.
Critically thinking
they're
as educators.
Signaling.
It's crazy.
Paid family leave running out of cash. Lee Green, Washington is a crash test dummy. That's a really good way to refer to our state. We're a crash test dummy for stupidity. Yes. Let's see. Shasho Windfeather. I think there should be... Are you Native American? I think
probably.
There should be more incentives for fully employer-paid programs like what my husband's employer has. They don't go through the states. Yeah.
But the thing is, your husband can still tack on the states. That's the thing is that we have at the radio station, most of the new fathers would get like 6 months leave because they would take the 3 months the company already gave them.
Yep.
And then they would get paid leave on top of that. And so now, I mean, it's awesome that they were able to, with their wives, they were able to take care of their kids for like 9 to 12 months in the first year, like without childcare.
Yeah.
But it's not our responsibility.
Right, not by taking other people's hard-earned money. No, that's ridiculous. Let's see. Dems asking for the murderer's pardon. Scrappy, crazy they couldn't find a better person to get behind. This guy needs to be deported. And I think he already has. Like, that's all been carried out. But I just wanted to revisit it today because, you know, we hadn't talked about it when it happened. And it bothered me that Deb Krishnadanson's name was on that. And it's also like, you guys put all these logos on it.
Oh, and as if, like, everybody in those communities supported it.
As if the city's demanding it. It's, I can't believe they were allowed to get away with that. Let's see. On the ballots being found in the Amazon order, Matt M. says, nothing says free and fair like 250 ballots showing up in your Amazon order. And she did immediately turn them in.
Luckily, somebody
that was... But
again,
I'm not ruling out the possibility that she was part of a... collusion to cast doubt on the election process. But I don't think you can ever rule it out entirely. But how? But still,
so far,
somebody
only
was
her,
able to steal 250 ballots and put them in that box without
only
people noticing.
One person received. Yeah. If she wasn't in on it,
right?
There was only one.
It's weird. I don't know. Hmm. But that's why there should be an immediate criminal investigation into it. Mm-hmm. Obviously. Let's see.
Although, if you were gonna pull that prank on yourself, would you put a lightsaber rice and paper plates in the box?
I love that it said toy lightsaber. Thing. It's like, oh, you mean it wasn't real? You mean it wasn't a real lightsaber? Wow, I didn't know.
And it was enough rice for a while.
Yeah, Watermelon Shug. Are those ballots made in China? Yeah, if they got there via Amazon, possibly.
Temu ballot.
Temu ballots. Man, I don't know if it's because you always talk about Temu, but I get these ads that pop up for Temu all the time.
Probably because we talk about it.
And there was like one for this like glass staircase with this chandelier. And I was like, how are they shipping that to me?
It's probably a picture of it.
Literally, it's probably a picture of it. Yes.
A banner.
Oh my gosh, that's too funny. A couple other super chats. Rick Eckert, late contribution to the Brandy DC Travel Fund. Great job calling out the mainstream media. Thank you. It was a very expensive last minute trip. And no, the president didn't pay for it, nor would we have allowed him to. I would have allowed Trump to pay for it, but not the taxpayers to pay for it. But I mean, that trip could have cost 10 grand and I still would have gone. Because, like, you don't say no. It's a once in a lifetime opportunity. Denise Young, for the DC Travel Fund. That's very nice of you guys. All right. Good comments per the usual. We'll get to our closing sanity check, which is going to be a long one today, but it's funny. First, don't forget to join me at the Engage Conference at the Maidenbauer Center in Bellevue. And let me know if you're going, by the way, if you've already signed up, because I want to know who's going to be there and who I need to make time to say hello to. It's coming up October 22nd. Jeez, is that next week? Holy smokes. Yep, October 22nd and 23rd. Like, October's already flying by. At the Maidenbauer Center in Bellevue, it is the annual conference put on by our friends at the Rental Housing Association of Washington. I'm going to be on a panel talking about how the media covers housing issues like rent control. Hint, not well. And we'll, of course, get into other things like homelessness and housing and all of that. But if you'd like to sign up to come, there's still some time. I think there's still some seats left. That was the last email I got from them. So rhawa.org. And while you're there, sign up to become a member of RHA if you're a small to mid-sized landlord. It's kind of like almost being part of a union as a landlord. And Lord knows that you need a little bit of solidarity to get through this insanity that's happening. So rhawa.org, the Rental Housing of Washington, has your back, rhawa.org. And with that, let's get to our closing sanity check. Okay, so President Donald Trump was on his peace mission, peace in the Middle East. And in Egypt, he was met there by other world leaders, including Italy's Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni. And he was standing up. There's all the leaders behind him. And she's the only chick. And the president says this.
We have a woman, a young woman who's I'm not allowed to say it because usually it's the end of your political career.
Oh,
if you
no.
say it. She's a beautiful young woman. Now, if you use the word beautiful in the United States about a woman, that's the end of your political career, but I'll take my chances. Where is she? There she is. You don't mind being called beautiful, right? Because you are. Thank you very much for coming. We appreciate it.
Now, I know how she feels because it's very self-serving. The president of the United States last week called me what?
It's much better to not have TDS. I'm happier, I'm healthier, more successful. I even think I got a little more attractive after I got rid of my Trump derangement syndrome. Yes, he called me very attractive, very attractive.
Here's what's funny about these two clips. If I'm not offended by a man complimenting me, you're not allowed to be offended on my behalf. And that's what I saw after the president said that to me. All these people out there being like, oh, that's gross, that's sick. Now, I don't know how Georgia Maloney felt about the president calling her beautiful in the moment. If she was offended by it, she has every right to be offended by it. But first of all, you can't be offended for the president calling me very attractive if I'm not offended by it. My husband wasn't even offended by it. In fact, he was quite excited that the president of the United States found me very attractive. One of the best compliments I've ever received. But it's this whole, just broader than that. And again, I don't know how Georgia Maloney felt about it, but you're not allowed to be offended for me if I'm not actually offended. And I think we have to renormalize men being able to compliment women without it immediately being painted as gross.
Please.
Make catcalling great again. Because you know what's happened to women like us and our single friends like Nicole? Men have turned into these scared sissies that are too afraid to give a woman a compliment or walk up to them at the bar or tell them they look nice. And so we're left here thinking, well, we just are ugly, horrible, gross-looking, grotesque monsters because no men ever compliment our appearances anymore. And women, you did that to them.
I agree.
So let them compliment. Let them give
Bring
us
back
compliments.
And catcalling and all the
cat
things.
Catcalling great again. There are limits, of course. But I say bring on the compliments. That has been our closing sanity check. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback.
I see new merch in that.
Make catcalling great again. Yes, I mean, obviously, there is a limit. There is a limit, of course.
Really is.
But you know what?
All the things. Like, I don't want to, like, I don't want to pay bills. I don't
want to, like, women, let's reevaluate the women's rights movement. Because you know what? I'd like to be a stay-at-home dog mom if I could. Let's be honest.
I meant food bills. We got, you know what I mean.
We got too many rights. Take them away. Not all of them. Obviously, that's a joke. But you think I get dressed up like this for myself? No, it's for you guys. My husband's not even home right now. So, you know what? Just give me a nice compliment and I'll take it. But you know what? If my husband doesn't give me a compliment when I get home, I will be offended. That has been our closing sanity check and our closing show. We'll see you back here, same time, same place, tomorrow.